Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, November 2nd. I'm Ray Graff. Today we welcome back the master of the strange universe himself. Bob Berman is with us. He is one of the best known, most widely read astronomers in the world. His latest book is Zapped, From Infrared to X-Rays, The Curious History of Invisible Light. Always a fun and informative program when Bob is here. Get your calls in now, 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. We talk astronomy today on Vox Pop. You can also email us, voxpop@wamc.org. But again, our number, 800-348-2551. He is in the house and ready to take your questions. Bob Berman is here. We'll begin after the news. Oh, hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. This afternoon, we welcome back renowned astronomer Bob Berman to the program. Bob is a great guest on this show. You know, he has been featured in Discover Magazine, Astronomy Magazine. He is the astronomy editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac, and he had a look at it today. I'm not sure if he's nonplussed about the whole thing, but we'll find out more coming up. Our number here on this program is 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. Bob's new book is Zapped, From Infrared to X-Rays, The Curious History of Invisible Light, copiously illustrated. We welcome Bob Berman back to the program, sir.
Great to be here. You know that nonplussed can mean either very surprised or the opposite, or could mean not surprised. Sort of the meaning has been going back and forth over the last
it's 10 or 20 years. It's kind of like commingled particles.
Yeah.
You know?
Sure.
And then to add another level of intellect to the program, we welcome Alan Chartok, who has some questions for Bob Berman. Welcome back to the show, Alan.
Thank you, Uncle Ray. Let's make it clear you literally manhandled me and brought me in here.
Because
I get enough time on the radio, you know.
You have such a deep question about the cosmos that I thought it was important that we ask this to a man who thinks about such things often.
Okay. So,
and here we go.
Okay, so here's the question. Of all the programs that have portrayed science fiction and space travel on the air, which is the one you think comes closest to the, you know, to the real truth?
That was not your question.
No, I changed the question.
You know,
because I wanted to know, because I started watching very young. I mean, I'm old now, much older than you. And my favorite program was Tom Corbett, Space Cadet. It was Tom Corbett, Manning, and Astro. Those were the three guys on there. So which of those programs that you observe from time to time, Star Trek and all the rest of them, comes closest to the real science?
I don't remember Tom Corbett, but yeah, I liked The Next Generation, Star Trek The Next Generation, with Patrick Stewart. He was a Shakespearean actor.
He was.
I thought he had more juice, more pizzazz than any of them. And the science was generally good on that.
Okay, so my big question that Ray wants me to ask.
Here we go.
Is this. Okay, like, we know definitively, as you've explained so well, so often, that where there's light, we can explore, we can make, we can map, we can do that. But then we know that that's only a teensy, tiny little particle on, you know, on that we know about. We don't even know if it's so infinitesimally small that it might be, you know, a leech on a leaf or something like that. So in other words, how do we know where it ends?
It ends at 258.30.
Well, we know where it begins. We don't know where it ends. We know it begins at 13.8 billion light years away because that's the distance at which everything is receding at the speed of light, meaning the light from anything from that point on will never get here. And if the light can't get here, we can never see it. And if we can't see any electromagnetic information, we can't get in any information. So the question is, from there, that point on, the universe keeps going. Does it end? Well, it doesn't seem to, because space-time, we now know, is flat up to that point.
Yeah.
And if it looked like it was heading toward an ending, there'd be a curvature suggesting that the sum total of all the mass in the universe will reach an end at some point. But because it's like grid lines on a graph, perfectly flat lines leading to that point, what we can infer is that either the universe, the larger universe beyond, is infinite, which presumably then it contains infinite numbers of galaxies and stars, goes on and on forever, which we can't even visualize, or it's so much larger than the visible universe that we can't even put a number on it. Debbie Elmgreen, professor of astronomy at Vassar, who was until last June the president of the American Astronomical Society, wow, the professional astronomers, when I talked to her about this a year or two ago, she said, well, yeah, but what we can see is probably 500 billion galaxies. That's enough to keep us busy for a while, even if it's only a tiny percentage of the actual universe. But she slightly misspoke, because if all we can see what we can see and the rest is infinite,
yeah,
any percentage of infinity is zero. Any percentage of infinity is zero. So it means that all we can ever observe is 0% of the universe that Dr. Chartok is talking about.
But, okay, now I get that. But every time we build a bigger telescope, right, we get more light. We can see more light. So then our universe, or what we can observe, expands. Is that right?
Well, our knowledge of it expands. It still stops at 13.8 billion light years, because that's the limit. At that distance, everything is so red-shifted that there's almost no light reaching us. So we still see that as a final cutoff, but we get more information about that spot.
So we can't see beyond that, no matter what?
That's right.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you. It's always a pleasure to be here. Ray, thank you for inviting me insisting that I speak here.
I thought it was good, and I'm glad you didn't put that other analogy into play that you mentioned in the newsroom.
Well, yeah, there are some things you don't say on the radio.
That was good.
Yeah.
You pulled it together pretty well. Alan Chartok, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, Alan, for being here. You want to stick around and take some calls?
Absolutely not.
All right. Well, our number is 800-348-2551. And take a call, we shall. Let's go to Mark in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on. Or not. Hello, Mark. Are you there?
It's your astronomers out of NYU. I have a question. Halloween was just nearby, but there's something called, I think, the Black Knight that's in our stratosphere somewhere, and there's also something called space worms, and that was sort of the spooky part of my question. But the other one is, historically, there's a fellow called Normand Lockyer, and I was wondering if you could comment on some of his discoveries and how close he got to maybe even Janssen and things like that, some historic knowledge about maybe what they used to know and we've forgotten, and maybe we're even rediscovering some of the things that were discovered years ago.
All right, before you start, what is the Black Knight?
No, this is new to me, and that name rings a distant bell, but honestly, I don't remember what I did last weekend. Tell me something about what he discovered, so at least it comes flooding back, and I can give you something on that.
I think he discovered from the sun, he discovered helium. Helium, and Janssen also discovered it at the same time, around the 1800s, but it was a major discovery, so perhaps that was something that made a difference. We were looking at the Fraunhofer lines.
That was a big deal, because until then there were a series of spectral lines on the sun that did not correspond with any heated element in an earthly lab, and all the other lines did, but there was one series that did not, so we had no idea what that was. And after helium was discovered on Earth in the 1890s, as you correctly say, then the discovery on Earth matched every missing spectral line on the sun. So we realized, hey, this is it. This is the final stuff. So helium was named helium after the Greek name for the sun god, Helios. And so there's the only one of the 92 natural elements that were discovered not on Earth.
Oh, how about that? All right, Mark. Well, thank you for the call. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Bob Berman is our guest. Before the program, I had mentioned to you the news from, I don't know, a week or two ago, that scientists, astronomers, had discovered an asteroid that was something of a rogue or an orphan and was just floating between solar systems or between galaxies and took a little pass by our sun.
Yes, it did. And we always know when that's the case, because a few days' observation of any newly discovered asteroid, meaning chunk of rock, immediately tells us what kind of orbit it has. And if it's going around the sun, it's going to be an elliptical orbit, at most a parabolic orbit, But a hyperbolic orbit, which is what this was, means that it's only coming through. It's not in any way attached to our solar system.
That's
pretty
a first,
rare.
Right? That we have found one?
No. It has been seen before, but it's rare. The speeds are always large, because if they were smaller speeds, it would be captured by the sun. And
it's going at, I think they said, 56,000 plus miles per hour.
That's right. And that makes more sense, because galactic speeds typically, for example, our own sun relative to the galaxy center is going 144 miles a second.
Okay.
And
times that speed.
Exactly. Earth going around the sun is 18 and a half miles a second, but the Earth going around the center of the galaxy is 144 miles a second. And so those are the kind of speeds associated with outside the solar system motion. So it's very obvious when there's something just whooshing in and out of the solar system.
So where did it come from?
Well, there's stuff out there. You know, the average density of matter is pretty low. It's about four atoms. I almost said four atoms per cubic meter of space. It's the other way around. It's one atom per four cubic meters of space. It's pretty empty.
Yep.
But you know, there's stuff. Not a lot of stuff, but there's stuff. And most of it's subatomic particles. That's what cosmic rays are.
Right.
Some of them come from the sun, but the majority come from other stars. The detritus from supernovae that are coming in. So to get a chunk like this that you could observe from Earth through an earthly telescope, that's much rarer. So it's interesting.
And we'll never see it again.
No.
Okay. Bob Berman is our guest. We will see him again. We'll take a break here, and we'll be right back. 800-348-2551, the number. 800-348-2551. We'll be right back on Vox Pop.
Support for WAMC comes from Careers in Transition, LLC, Albany. Dr. Tom Denham, providing individual career guidance, career testing, job strategies, interview preparation, LinkedIn lessons, resume and cover letter writing. CareersInTransitionLLC.com. Vermont Coffee Company, offering slow-roasted organic coffee in the brown paper bag at local grocery stores. Vermont Coffee Company, coffee roasted for friends. Lori Donovan designs Lennox. For over 40 years, offering contemporary and estate jewelry, as well as colored gemstones, specializing in custom handmade jewelry, repurposing, and repairs. LoriDonovan.com. From the Preservation League of New York State, Albany, partnering in preserving historic New York through advocacy, education, grants, and loans. So our past has a future. PreserveNYS.org. And from Dr. Lucy Chapik, Latham, New York, a plastic surgeon dedicated to aesthetic cosmetic surgery, fat transfers, facial rejuvenation, breast augmentation, and laser and skin care since 1996. 518-786-1700.
Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here, along with astronomer Bob Berman, and you at 800-348-2551. And back to the phones we go, and it's David in New Paltz. David, you're on.
Hi, Ray. Thanks for a good job there. Thank you. Bob.
Hi.
Listen, I know that we're having climate change and the ice sheet is melting, but I wanted to ask Bob, what would that do if all the ice melted in the to the axis of the Earth and its relationship to the moon and the tides, et cetera, and going around the sun, similar as the weight shifting on a top? That's my question.
Okay.
Well, considering that when Japan sunk a couple of feet during the Fukushima the disaster, the earthquake that caused that, a Richter magnitude 9 earthquake, and that tsunami, it was accompanied by Japan actually sinking. And that was enough to increase the speed of Earth by a fraction of a millisecond. So the Earth is very sensitive, just like a ballerina, because of the shift in angular momentum, just like a ballerina pulling in her or his arms changes the spin rate. Things that change their position from the surface of the Earth to being further down or further up, that like earthquakes can do. However, in this case, we've got ice melting. Now, the ice, as you know, is less dense than the water. It's sitting on the top of the water, but it's less dense than the water. So once it melts, only one-tenth of the ice is sitting above the surface of the water. So there's no real change in overall mass, because there's not new mass being added to the surface of the Earth. There's just maybe a tiny bit that may have been above the surface, the water that's now no longer above the surface. So I would think this would be measurable, but not anything that would affect you and me or create any kind of disaster.
All right, David, thanks for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is here.
Did that sound like a good answer? You know, I make this stuff up.
Well, you do very well. You sound very authoritative. His new book, also authoritative, Zapped, From Infrared to X-Rays, The Curious History of Invisible Light. Let's go over to David, who's southbound on the thruway. How you doing? Oh, it's Dwight. I'm sorry. Dwight, you're on.
Hey, great. Sorry. Very excited. I thought of a second quick yes or no question. Can you see any other galaxies unaided?
Yes.
With the naked eye when you look up?
So yes. There's one, and then maybe a second. There's the Andromeda Galaxy, and you're asking at the right time of year, and you're asking at the right time of the month.
The real question that I had was, everybody's always talking about when the Big Bang started. And I'm assuming the galaxies are moving in the same direction as they always have. Can you figure out where the Big Bang happened based on the trajectories of the galaxies that are moving around?
Yes. Yeah, that's fortunately easy to do. So to answer the first part of your question, the Andromeda Galaxy, not hard at all if you're away from the lights of Albany or any city. It looks like a little fuzzy patch. If we were together under the sky tonight or the next clear night, I'd point it out with a laser and then you'd see it easily without me or another astronomer being there. Just look around the sky. Look for a little blurry, elliptical-looking patch, and that's it. There's one other, if you're in really dark skies, a galaxy named M33 in the little constellation of Triangulum, which is actually near the Andromeda Galaxy. That one's much more marginal, and that's harder to see. But if you're in southern New Mexico, I actually saw it from my backyard in Willow, which is not too far from Woodstock, on a very crisp, dark, unpolluted night, so it can be seen from here.
M33. Now that strikes a note. Is that that's not a spiral?
It is, but it's a face-on spiral. So it looks very round and blobby.
Yes.
So now,
up another question. Is it easier to look in the winter up because there's less pollution, less cars driving around?
Well, again, there's two sides. It's better because the air is drier in the winter, and drier air doesn't hold as much moisture, so you don't get that haze. On the other hand, when there's a snow cover, the snow cover reflects streetlights back into the sky and adds more light pollution than you see in the warmer part of the year. So the two are kind of mixed and contradictory signals, unless you're away from the lights of town. And then I'd say as long as you don't have streetlights reflecting the snow cover back up, then I'd say winter is better. But your question about the galaxies, can you tell where the Big Bang happened by their motions? Yes, you can, but it's a little different from what you might have expected. We've observed since 1929 that all the galaxies are racing directly away from us. Now, you'd get that effect if one of two different things happened. Either the Big Bang explosion happened right here, and everything is racing directly away from us, as it would in an explosion. Or the Big Bang happened equally everywhere to the entire universe, in which case, no matter where you were, you'd still see everything racing away from you. So one of those two is correct. Either there was a location and it was here, but then that violates the Copernican idea that there's no preferred spot in the universe, or it happened equally. And everyone is in agreement that it happened equally everywhere. The usual analogy is a balloon with, let's say, white ants equally on its surface. If you inflate the balloon, each ant sees the other ants moving away from it. Mm-hmm. And the ant right next to it moves away more slowly, and the ant on the other side of the balloon moves away from it faster if there's an even inflation of the balloon. And so it just means the whole thing is expanding. And so that's what's happening. So where is the Big Bang? It's equally everywhere. It's right where you are.
Dwight, thank you for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest, and we go to Merle in Argyle. Hello, Merle, you're on.
Thank you. Hi, guys. All right, I'm back again. This is the homework question.
Oh, good.
I did it this time, Merle.
Oh, you did get it. All right, good.
I looked it up, and
Merle, refresh our memory as to what the question
is. Basically, that Christopher Columbus, he was shipwrecked or something on Jamaica and said to the Indians or the natives that they weren't going to feed him anymore, and he said, well, if you don't feed me, I'm going to start eating out the sun. And the lunar eclipse, I assume that's what it was, it started, and then they started feeding him again.
Oh, I'll be darned. All right, so what was your homework?
So what I found out was that I should have known about this, because it was a famous eclipse that's come to be known as the Christopher Columbus eclipse. It really did happen. It was not a solar eclipse, though. That's what puzzled me before, because back in those days, in the 15th century, predictions of solar eclipses and where they would occur on Earth were not very accurate. But predictions of lunar eclipses were much better, because a lunar eclipse is seen from half the world at a time.
So they wouldn't have to worry about the fact that the Earth was bigger than they thought.
None of that. And they wouldn't have to worry about where it was going to be seen and where it wasn't going to be seen, because half the whole world sees a lunar eclipse. It was not the sun being blocked or partially blocked. It was the moon. That night, the moon got eaten up and disappeared, and or at least turned blood red, and it properly freaked out the natives. And he impressed them, and then told them, okay, we'll bring it back. And sure enough, because these eclipses tend to last an hour, and then the moon returns. So, yes, famous incident. I'm glad you brought that to our attention.
Thank you for your persistence.
All right, thank you very much.
Yeah, have a good one. We appreciate it. 800-348-2551, the number. Bob Berman is our guest on the program. Anthony in Cooperstown. Anthony, you're on.
Hi, thank you. Several years ago, I don't remember how many, I read or heard a little blip about rock-eating microbes that were discovered in some outer space or particle. Is that anything you know anything about it? I find it a fascinating concept, especially the science fiction part of my brain.
Right, and the science fiction is real, because if I remember, one episode of The Next Generation in Star Trek had these nano creatures eating some of the ship, eating the ship's material, and it wasn't good for the ship. But no, in real life, no microbes have ever been discovered. If that were true, this would be the biggest thing, that we had found extraterrestrial life of any form. And if we ever do find extraterrestrial life, it probably would be in the form of microbes, just on the basis that there are more little things in the universe. And then there are big things, more minnows than whales, even in Earth's oceans. But so, no microbes have ever been found to either eat rock or leave rock alone.
Okay.
Thanks, Anthony. We appreciate the call. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Bob Berman is our guest. And over to Mark in Rock Hill. Mark, you're on.
Hi, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call. I try to be on almost regularly when you have that astronomical guest. I have two. One could be a big question or quick, depending upon how your guest wants to interpret this.
Okay.
But the quicker question is: is it true that plankton was found on the outer windows of the space station, and how could that be? That's one question. And number two, I want to know how your guest feels about all of these ancient astronauts astronaut theories that are going around and the TV shows that are propagating because of that. I'm going to hang up and let you go ahead. Thank you so much.
All right, Mark.
Sure.
Plankton on the outside of the space station.
I've not heard this, and probably for a good reason, because it would be astonishing if it happened. Of course, since we have not yet discovered any life outside of Earth, we would not have plankton from space. Only if it was contaminated, if the space shuttle had been contaminated prior to liftoff.
Okay, and I think that may be what he is driving at, is that some things have survived out there, right, that were on the ship?
Well, we know that things can survive. The most famous one is the Surveyor spacecraft, which was left on the moon. And when the second Apollo lander, Apollo 12, landed on the moon and they hopped over, they were deliberately landing within a few hundred yards of the old Surveyor, which had been on the moon for over 2 years. And the idea was they were going to snip off some of the foam in the insulation of the cameras and take it back and see what were the effects of being in a vacuum and being in these temperature extremes. What would 2 years on the moon do to these earthly materials? And so when it was brought back, they found, to their astonishment, that there was a Streptococcus bacterium, a living Streptococcus, in that Surveyor on the moon material. So it had survived for 2 years in the vacuum of the moon.
Okay, now how do we know that that was not a contaminated experiment and that that Streptococcus was not earthbound when they brought it back?
That's the big question. And when there was controversy, and you know there's going to be a controversy about that, to this day you'll find a minority opinion, because the majority thinks it actually was, I mean, of course it was contaminated, but the idea is it was contaminated, which shouldn't have been,
before
it was sent up
right there.
And that's what most believe. But is it possible that the Streptococcus was introduced, as you suggest, after it was brought back? Well, a lot of care was taken, as you can imagine, to keep this isolated and sterile before it was examined. So it would have been a major slip up for that bacterium to have been introduced afterward. But many think that's what happened.
Wow. Okay. And that's one part of his question. And the other part is ancient astronauts.
Well, you know, that's TV stuff, you know, of course. I mean, if we were really visited by creatures from another star system, that would be a whole big deal. Unfortunately, many of these programs explain things that really need no explanation. For example, that the Great Pyramid built in 2500 BC. We couldn't have done that. The Egyptians, you know, who were they? They didn't have cranes and the smarts that we currently have. How could they have built the pyramid? So it took the brains of some extraterrestrials to have helped them with that. And so these premises are a little bit, to my mind, they're a little bit ethnocentric and time-centric, saying that we, especially white people here on this part of the world, can do almost anything, but those slobs back in Egypt and those things, they couldn't have done that. They needed help. And so, therefore, ancient astronauts were needed. But I've not seen anything that was done on Earth that can't be explained and the Egyptologists are so sure that it was created on Earth, that they even, when we had a real controversy, Ray, about 20 years ago, when we found the main passageway of the main pyramid, points not quite to the North Star, but just ever so slightly away from it. And then why? It would have pointed to the North Star 500 years before the pyramid was built. Does that mean we're wrong about when the pyramid was built? And it turns out the Egypt experts were so sure about that they had the whole thing nailed down, they said, we are not 500 years off about when the pyramid was built.
Okay.
The passageway points almost to the North Star for a different reason.
Oh, interesting. Now, speaking of the Great Pyramid, did you see the news today?
Yes, that it has a space in it, an empty space.
And the way they have detected it.
From muons.
Fascinating. Explain for our listeners what they did.
Well, yes, using the property that muons pass through less dense materials.
These are cosmic rays, right?
They're actually daughters of cosmic rays.
Interesting.
Right. In other words, cosmic rays create muons. When they strike air molecules about 35 miles up, the result, like a cue ball hitting a stack of billiards, is a rain of muons. Now, each muon is about 200 times 208 times less massive than an electron. So it's a very lightweight. I'm sorry.
Electrons have mass?
Yeah, they have mass, sure. They have 1,836 times less mass than a proton.
Hmm.
But they have mass. And I went the other way. I said that muons are 208 times less massive than an electron. They're 208 times more massive than an electron. So they're not as heavy as a proton or a neutron, but they have some heft to them.
Okay.
But the key is that they only live for 2 millionths of a second, 2.3 millionths of a second, microseconds.
All right.
And then they decay into, they decay into electrons and a neutrino. So they don't live long. And yet, 240 of them on average go through each of our bodies, yours and mine, every second.
Okay.
So we're being invaded and struck by them, and they're not even completely harmless because you get a muon going through a wrong bit of genetic material in one of your cells' DNAs and could give rise to a later tumor 20, 30
okay.
years.
Okay, fair
away.
Enough.
So those are muons. So in this case, the muon penetration, they had ways to see where the muons were going through the pyramid and where they weren't, and then show that they've got there's a hole, there's a cavity. Is it deliberate, or is it just the way they build things back then?
That's very interesting, though.
So if you've ever been to the main, to any of the pyramids, going there, I'm not claustrophobic, but boy, this is the first time I felt that way because it's a small, you have to bend over the whole way. There's no air. You feel stuffy, and it just keeps going and going and going, and you're stuck. You know you're stuck inside. There's only one way out, and that's behind you. And I find it very hard to get to the main, what is the word for it? There's a little room that there's not much there, and it's not even a large room, but that's where you're going to with the main passageway.
Mm-hmm.
So it turns out right above it, there's another space,
yes,
empty space.
About the same size.
And they don't know whether this is has something in it or whether it's just like a leftover space. When you build something, you may have an empty space,
right,
like your attic is,
sure,
sometimes.
So, well, it's all very fascinating.
Fascinating,
more fascinating, I think. Well, as fascinating as the presence of this room is how they did it. And so that's why I brought it up with you. Bob Berman is our guest. We'll take a break here, and then we'll get back to the phones. 800-348-2551 is our number. Astronomy Today, we'll be right back.
Support for WAMC comes from Merriman & Fisher's Marketplace Del Mar, an independent artisan gift shop offering pottery, jewelry, glassworks, woodcrafts, paintings, and photography from artists in the community and beyond. MerrimanFisher.com. Colby Attorney's Service, document filing, document and information retrieval, and other services including legal publishing and corporate record searches. ColbyService.com. Mass Match, for over 15 years, a locally owned dating and matchmaking service connecting singles through private matchmaking in Western Massachusetts and beyond. MassMatch.com. Capital Roots, rescuing and distributing fresh food to Capital Region shelters, food pantries, and soup kitchens. CapitalRoots.org for information on how to support the Squash Hunger Program. And from the VNA and Hospice of the Southwest Region, providing home health and hospice care since 1946 throughout Bennington and Rutland counties, VermontVisitingNurses.org.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. Astronomer Bob Berman, our guest. His new book is Zapped, From Infrared to X-Rays, The Curious History of Invisible Light. And before we get back to the phones, Bob, here's one that came in via email from our buddy Jules. What does the verification of the existence of gravity waves or gravitational waves by the amazing LIGO Observatory contribute to our understanding of black holes and space-time? Answer that in a minute.
Right. Well, you know, it's a confirmation. We didn't really need it because Einstein's general relativity of 1915 has been confirmed in so many different ways. But it's a confirmation that he was right, that space-time can have, which we just thought of as emptiness, can have properties that it can actually change its dimension. It can compress and open up space and time. And so to actually measure that, and the fact that we can actually see that that happened, tiny, tiny wiggle of it, and the amount of jiggling of it showed us what types of objects were doing the compressing of space-time. Fascinating, really fascinating. So it's more like a triumph of science. It's cool stuff.
Let's go to Vern in Lenox, Massachusetts. Vern, you're on.
Yes. Hello, Ray and Bob. Thank you.
Sure.
Bob, my question is in regard to the the stars at night always seem to be the same. We can count on seeing the same stars. But yet, what I expect with all the movement that we are encountering, the spinning of the Earth, rotation around the sun, and then yet another rotation, I guess, with the galaxy, with all this different movement, I'm expecting to see a different, like more of an erratic or unpredictable movement of the stars.
Well, it depends on how patient you are. You know, some of the ancient Greeks observing the sky had noted that some of the stars, such as Arcturus, bright spring star, had shifted their position slightly from earlier catalogs. So the stars that we see in the night sky are like adjacent horses on a carousel. So while we go around the galaxy center, they're like the other horses on a carousel. They're going around with us. So they generally have the same motion around the center of the galaxy that we do, unless the odd one doesn't. Arcturus is a good example of that because it doesn't take part in that flat pancake-like rotation. Comes in at us from the north, plunges through the galaxy, exits the south, and so it changes rapidly, and it wasn't even visible 50,000 years ago. So there are some changes, but by and large, you'd have to live for a couple thousand years to notice them at all.
Why does Arcturus do that?
It's the only one that we know of that does it. We don't even know. It's almost like, could it be a visitor? No, it can't be a visitor from another galaxy because it would have a different speed.
So it's the only one.
Yeah.
And it has the same speed as everybody else?
It has a similar speed, but a totally different orbit. So it's going, it too is going around the center of the galaxy, but it's going around it perpendicular to the other stars.
Is there a possibility that there are more that we have not seen yet?
Yes.
You said this one was not visible until 50,000 years ago.
That's right. And maybe there are some very, very faint ones that astronomers have discovered that I'm not aware of. It's the only certain of the named bright stars that do this.
Huh. Well, that's fascinating. Yeah. And all the physics hold up?
Yeah.
Interesting. Back to the phones and Rick in Westbrookville. Rick, you're on.
Hey, Ray, is this actually you?
Is this actually Rick?
Yeah, this is actually Rick. I've been listening to you for a long time.
Hey, thanks.
It's my pleasure. Bob, listen to your last program when you were given the homework assignment. I've listened for quite a long time. But anyway, I have a simple question, I guess, hopefully. All right. But it's about red laser as opposed to a green laser in daytime as far as its ability to be more visibly seen. Or do they both have basically the same intensity?
Well, all handheld lasers to be legal have to be 5 milliwatt or less, although you can buy some boosted lasers from China that you could get for even 100 milliwatts. But let's say you stick with the 5 milliwatt red laser or the green laser, you'll see the green laser much more readily because the eye is much more sensitive to green light than red light.
That was basically my question, because of the light light density in the daytime as opposed to the red, what's the proper word I'm looking for? All right, as far as the light spectrum is concerned, the red is more visible at night, and the green is a more acceptably visible light during the day.
But no, our eyes are more sensitive.
Am I wrong?
The eye is more sensitive to green at all times. Plus,
at all times.
Yes, plus the green light lets you see the beam. And the red lasers, you don't see the beam.
That's the other part of my question. You know, I'm so glad I listened.
Well, thanks, Rick.
You know, I needed to talk to somebody that was a hell of a lot more intelligent than I am. I'm sorry about that. I mean, I hope you didn't have to beat that.
No, you're all right. You're all right.
Hey, Ray?
Yeah.
Ray, for you?
Yeah.
No matter what show you host, I love listening to you.
Well, you know, thanks,
you
man.
You do a great job.
I wish Shark Talk was still in here. Maybe I get a raise out of this.
No, I like Alan, but I don't always agree with Alan. But you are one great host.
Well, thanks, man. We appreciate the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. So the red and green visibility, this is the same reason that some people don't see red auroras?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Red auroras are almost impossible to see. And then when you get to low light, you're dealing with our scotopic vision, which is a whole different type of vision that we get in low light that are produced by rod-shaped cells, 20 million rod-shaped cells, and then that introduces a whole other can of worms into it because we don't see dim red light at all, not even as gray. It doesn't even have a gray analog. So for a variety of reasons, the green is better. Also, the green lasers are circularly polarized, which means it hits dust particles in a way that will reflect their light back to us, whereas the red light is linearly polarized.
Why can't you circularly polarize the red laser?
The way they're made, the materials that are the crystals that are actually producing the red versus the green set up the polarization from the beginning. And one type allows you to see the reflection of in the red, you might be able to see the reflection if you were at the object. If you were on the star or on the moon looking back at the person pointing it, then you'd have a chance of seeing the beam. But if you're the one holding the laser, which we always are, we're not out there in space, you don't see a beam with red, but you do with green.
That's very cool. All right, yeah. Let's go to Saul in Schenectady. Let's call Saul. You're on.
Hi. I have a question. With all of the really huge new telescopes that are being built up, like on the desert in Chile and all of that, my question is, how much better is the viewing from Hubble, which is a couple hundred miles up, than these new telescopes that are maybe 5 miles or whatever above sea level?
Well, Hubble always is going to do better than even Chile. We go down there every year. I'd love to have more of our listeners join us. Type in my name and tours and come with us on some of these Chile tours. We do that every year. And we go to visit some of the big observatories. That's the only place in the world that big observatories are now being built. And they're not in the desert. They're being built by and large on mountaintops. For example, Las Campanas, the one run by the Carnegie Institution, is up at 8,000 feet.
Yeah.
They're always on in the Chilean foothills, really.
This is dry air and low light?
Exactly, dry air. And what you get with the dry air, too, is the higher up you go, the more the infrared is going to penetrate. And astronomers are increasingly interested in infrared because when you're looking at galaxies, their light is being redshifted so that the more distant galaxies, they're not even visible in the visible part of the spectrum anymore. They've been redshifted all the way into the IR. So Hubble can see IR. And by the way, the James Webb telescope, scheduled for launch late next year, will only be an infrared instrument, not even a visual telescope at all. So when you get to the infrared, then it becomes even more important.
So they redshift to infrared, and then there's nothing they can shift to beyond that?
No, past the infrared, you'd be getting into radio waves.
Why can't you? They have radio telescopes.
You could, but radio telescopes don't have the resolution because the waves are so long. Radio waves, you can be a mile from wave to wave, so you don't get the sharpness. You don't get the detail that you do in visible light.
But getting back to the conversation we had at the beginning of the program, and you said 13.8 billion years, that's the wall. Regardless of the telescope you use, whether it's in space or whatever, 13.8 billion, at that point, everything's redshifted beyond being able to see, right?
Correct.
Why don't you point your radio telescope then at that point and see if you can see anything beyond 13.8 billion?
It's been done, but you still couldn't because all types of electromagnetic radiation travel at the speed of light. They all have that limit. They're not going to get past that limit by changing.
Is it an artificial limit or is that it?
No, it's a limit because whether you look at light as a wave or a particle, the speed of the light is reaching light speed itself, 186,282.4 miles per second at that distance. So the light can't get here. In other words, the object that's, this is a better way to think of it, the object that's emitting the light is flying away at a faster speed than the light could travel.
Okay. All right. Back to the phones here and get a couple of more calls in. We go over to Susie in Schenectady. Susie.
Hi, Ray. Hi, Bob. I'm so happy to talk to you both.
Hi. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And, Bob, I just want to tell you an infinite number of thank yous. I know this is late in the game. I tried to call last time, but I couldn't get through. Our family went to see the eclipse.
Oh,
and I remember what you said about how you wouldn't even step outside your door for something that was 80%, but a total eclipse of the sun would change your life. And I thought, oh, come on. That's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
But we went, and, you know, you're a man of your word. And it was true. We took our kids and their friends. So we had five teens and young adults, and we drove 25 hours.
Wow.
We were trying to get close. Yeah, 25 hours. We were trying to get to Carbondale, and I was like, you know, looking at the maps, and we were looking to try and get to Totality. And so we found a town that was just a little bit north of Carbondale, and they were offering, it was a church, and they were offering, you know, their parking lot, and they had bathrooms, and they had vendors and air conditioning. And we were like, good, we're set. And it was awesome. And they were like, where are you all from? And we're like, we're from New York. And they're like, oh, my gosh. And then my kids were walking around, and they were like, hey, do you guys know that there are people from New York here? And my kids were like, that's us. But the kids, they loved it. They said it was totally worth it. We actually had an exchange student with us, too. And when I asked him what his favorite part of the summer was, he said, hands down, it was the eclipse.
Oh,
I'm so glad to hear it. So I take it that you had you had clear weather for it.
That's great. Susie, thanks a lot for the call.
Oh, wait. Susie, did you have clear weather at your site? Oh, you did.
They must have.
They must have.
They had a good time.
Yeah, good.
All right,
because Carbondale itself had some tragedies there. You know, at that stadium they set up for everybody, clouds came in just as the eclipse started.
I don't know if that's a tragedy, but I mean, come on.
So I'm glad these people.
Somebody gets hurt. All right, let's go to Tim in Utica. Tim, you're on. Tim.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead, man.
Yeah, I hear some scientist or a young astronomer says there's another planet within our solar plane. Is that true?
The discovery of another planet.
Well, we're still thinking that Planet 9 may exist. The planet that's most likely is mathematically likely based on the motion of a half dozen Kuiper Belt objects that have very strange orbits, and we wonder why they're moving the way they are and why they have these very odd orbits around the sun. And mathematically, it turns out that if there is a very, very large planet, bigger than Jupiter even, very far from the sun in a particular spot, it could explain these Kuiper Belt objects' existence as in orbiting in this strange fashion. So mathematically, you could say that the planet has been detected by its influence, but until someone actually observes it, then the discovery is not real until someone observes it, and maybe they will, maybe they won't.
How many objects have we cataloged in the Kuiper Belt?
I don't know the answer to that, but, you know, many, especially now that we've thrown objects that we didn't even know were Kuiper Belt objects, like Pluto, Makemake, Sedna, Quarwar, Charon. These are all Kuiper Belt objects that we knew about before we even called them Kuiper Belt objects.
I thought Charon was a moon of Pluto.
It is. But as Pluto is, so is Charon.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
you make a point.
Yeah.
And so whatever this theoretical Planet 9 is, it's really far out there, beyond the Kuiper Belt?
Yes, yes.
And how is it affecting the orbits of these other objects that are much closer?
Well, just from its gravitational influence.
Amazing.
Analogous to the way Uranus, with its little 84-year orbit around the sun, was moving oddly enough to allow for the Englishman Adams and the Frenchman Le Verrier in 1846 to find Neptune, based on the strange orbit of Uranus before that. So this is the same kind of thing.
All right, quickly, we only have less than one minute for Donovan in Marlboro, Vermont. Donovan, you have about 20 seconds to pose the question.
Okay, I've got a small question, and my name is Jonathan.
Oh, Jonathan. It says Donovan that's here, but Jonathan, you're good.
That's okay. So if there, I've heard about this idea of multiple universes, and if that's true, isn't a universe contained instead of infinite? And I mean, you could have a whole program on this.
Oh, I love it. We have 15 seconds
left.
Okay,
so then it depends on definitions. If you're saying that all the multiple universes we could ever conceive are really part of the meta-universe beyond, then by definition, the visible universe is just one of multiple. But remember, this is giving a lot of people a little bit of anxiety, because are we saying multiple universes just to say that anything we can't explain here must be part of some other universe or a multiple universe? It's a can of worms. We should talk about it sometime.
Yeah, and not with less than a minute to go on the program. Hey, Bob, thanks a lot.
Sure.
And once again, the new book is Zapped, From Infrared to X-Rays, The Curious History of Invisible Light. Thanks to Bob Berman for being here. Support comes from Jane Iredale, a mineral makeup company specializing in makeup that is good for the skin. Jane Iredale Retail Shop at Louisa Ellis Boutique, Great Barrington, JaneIredale.com. Curtis Lumber announcing their new kitchen showrooms featuring kitchen design trends and cabinets from Wellborn and Merillat and quartz countertops from Cambria. CurtisLumber.com. The New York State Bar Association's Lawyer Referral and Information Services, offering assistance via a new website, findalawyerny.org. And Sheehy Opticians Albany, providing eye exams and eyeglasses, including Bevel, LaFont, and Pro Design, progressive lenses from Varilux at Nikon, at Maui Jim, Costa, and Ray-Ban sunglasses, Sheehy Opticians.com. Thanks again to astronomer Bob Berman for being here today. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Your phones are answered by Colleen O'Connell, and great calls today. Thank you so much for listening. Tomorrow on Food Friday, Bill Johnston and Peter Blackman return to discuss holiday food and wine. Right now, stand by for news.